don't give up hope, folks. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And yes, it's Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Late, but here. Stay with us. The November 2nd, 2000 show. God knows how many shows we've done. A little late tonight because the battery was dead and I had to spend a few minutes with some able help getting it together to get to the studio. My apologies for keeping you waiting and my thanks to the prior talk show host for tiding me over as always. This, of course, is 96.3 Free Radio Santa Cruz at 427-3772. That's the call-in line. That's the magic number. 427-3772 if you want to be on the air. If you want to leave a message for free radio off the air, of course, it's 427-4523. That's the voicemail. If you got loop tapes or public announcements, demos, money, who knows what, but stuff you don't want on the air but you want directed to the Free Radio Santa Cruz Management, that's the collective, 427-4523, or mail it to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz 95061. We're on the web, www.microradio.net/FRSC, and an email address is frsc@microradio.net. Forgotten any of those numbers, then give a call to 427-4523. And the group I work with, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, also takes calls about this show off air. If you've got questions and comments you want to make, but you're feeling a bit reluctant to make them on the air, my producer will probably be picking up the phone at 423-HUF, 423-4833. HUF is the acronym for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a decade-old civil rights organization concerned with the rights of folks outdoors, as lots of folks are tonight. Based on the last census, we figure 1,000 to 2,000 in the city limits of Santa Cruz itself, maybe 6,000 to 10,000 in the county of Santa Cruz itself. The overwhelming majority of these people, technically illegal when they go to sleep because of the city's sleeping ban, and similar, somewhat less harsh, but equally extensive sleeping bans in the county. Actually, the county ban has a higher fine than the city's, but it doesn't include the private property, which the city does in terms of front yards, driveways, and so forth. Still, basic human rights violation that we in Santa Cruz have been trying to correct for the two decades since the city ban has been in force, when it was passed in 1978. And, of course, we have an election coming up in 5 days on Tuesday, November 7th, at which the city council will have a four-seat shift. That is to say, four people are giving up their seats. One of them actually is running for re-election, Michael Hernandez. The other three, Byers, Matthews, and Rotkin, are leaving their seats at least for 2 years. I'm afraid we can expect to see the recycling council members coming back again, as Rotkin has done perennially. Hopefully not, but probably so. And so it's an important election because if some real strong new voices got in, there might be some changes around police department policy, around how Latinos are treated in the beach flats, how affordable housing is ignored or used to actually reduce the housing stock and to drive out poor people rather than to help poor people stay in town, as has been the case with the Dolphin Lee Project, and more about that later in the show. We don't really have many good candidates this time. I have been essentially saying I'm going to vote for Argue and nobody else. There's been some concern also. Well, other people have had different views. In fact, more recently I've kind of upgraded my view based on the public statements and, more important, the presence of candidate Bonnie Moore at different forums, the Fiesta at the Dolphin Lee, the Dolphin Lee televised forum, banned by Scan, but still quite successful, that we held last Saturday. Her presence at a number of the votes at City Council, the most recent special midday noon City Council session 2 days ago, where City Council did a complete surprise by giving Mercy Charities Housing $1.5 million to buy the Dolphin instead of turning over the, instead of buying it for the city and then letting Mercy Charities manage it. Mercy Charities is going to be given the title to the whole thing in a decision that was only announced last Friday and, of course, was a done deal, a slam dunk. And I actually have some tape on that, but I'm not quite sure it's good enough for publication, or I should say for broadcast. On Sunday, however, I will be coming back. The show returns from 11 to 1:30 in the afternoon on Sundays, and I will have access to the City Council tape, which is much more audible, and hopefully I'll have my expert analyst in the studio, Scott Graham, who has, again, been following these issues for years, knows more about redevelopment law and the history of the city and the beach south of Laurel scandal and scam than I do, and a lot of this, I think, does link back to that attempt to give the Seaside Company a vast amount of development power to realign 3rd Street, to set up a commercial development stopped temporarily by an electoral landslide and community organizing in 1998, 2 years ago. But this year, it's the stealth business interests are on the move again with Kennedy and Hernandez and Premack and possibly even some of the scandidates. The scandidates, I mean the scan-endorsed candidates. I'm going to actually be talking about this subject at some length later tonight at a special public forum being sponsored by Jim Costner. Jim, we used to call Just Man Jim when he was fighting the sleeping ban 3 or 4 years ago, going to jail for it, and he actually went to jail this year for a fight against the sleeping ban. Actually, it wasn't a fight against the sleeping ban. It was a fight to assure the rights of protesters, and he was taken away for, I think, resisting arrest after the police had, in the minds of many of us, illegally seized a woman named Go Ling Liao on May 22, 1999 at the Democratic Party dinner where we were protesting the bombing of Yugoslavia. That was about a year and a half ago, year and a quarter ago. And police just moved in, grabbed a woman with a boombox, put her in a vehicle to take her away, wouldn't tell anybody what they were doing, including her, ended up dropping charges against her. But when people surrounded the police van, they began forcefully arresting people, attacked one woman with a child in the famous Steve Argue case, where Steve punched Officer Lefebvre to get him to stop his arm, hand, finger, pain compliance hold of this woman who seemed about to drop her child, and as a consequence served 7 months in jail for a felony assault on a police officer. Lefebvre was relieved of his duty or, if you believe the police version, moved on to a better job in another jurisdiction in the East Bay. Of course, we don't have the results of the independent investigation, so we can't tell what actually happened in that case. It was stamped classified at birth. Candidate Arnie Leff, who is also the head of the Police Review Board, has not made any public strong statements demanding that report be released, as he should have for the last year and a half. Instead, he's running for City Council and trying to keep his record on the CPRB as little analyzed and discussed as he can, and I'm trying, of course, to bring it up. But there will be this forum later tonight. I was talking about Jim Costner's history. Jim has gone to jail for opposing the sleeping ban on several occasions. He wants to start a new campaign against the sleeping ban and mobilize people to begin protests. I've heard a similar sentiment from David Silva, who is also interested in, as I understand it, starting a fast again and getting fasters to begin their fast even before the election, because the momentum needs to be in his mind. And I agree with him, and I agree with Jim Costner, stepped up. And I'm, of course, always unsure of the best way to do this. A lot of it depends on where there's the will and whether there are the forces and whether there are the resources to do it. And I guess tonight at the Loudoun Nelson Center from 7 to 9, may even go on to 10, there's going to be this forum on the sleeping ban. I'll be speaking there. Becky Johnson will be speaking there. I believe David Silva will be speaking there. Everyone's invited to come down to Loudoun Nelson tonight, listen in, and tell me what you think. And we're really trying to begin a new organization to get this matter resolved before Christmas. And I'm going to be talking, my speech tonight there is going to be about the election and the sleeping ban and what the candidates are doing. I guess I should talk about it a bit here tonight on the air, since I suppose some of the audience out there is not going to make it to this forum, and people might want to know who to vote for. As I said, I'm probably going to vote for Moore and Argue and then leave the other two city council spaces blank. And you might say, is that wasting your vote? No. Because of the way things are counted, the less votes for other candidates, the less the total vote total, the less the number of votes required to elect any one of the candidates. That's my understanding. And that being the case, if you just voted for one, you'd actually increase significantly, and significantly perhaps not, but certainly if a lot of people did that, that would increase significantly that particular candidate's chance of winning. So you wouldn't be throwing away your ballot. So I think I'm going to be voting for Moore and for Argue, Steve Argue. And I recommend others do the same. I think more important than any vote on Election Day, of course, is your actions after Election Day. We have numerous actions coming up. There's going to be Happy John Dine anniversary coming up. That's the homeless man, or actually homeless activist. He had housing when he was shot dead by police officer Connor Carey on November 12th, 1997, at Front and Water Streets at the bus stop there on Front Street. Actually, it's not Front and Water, it's Front and Soquel. Sorry about that. That's right across from the parking lot of the New Leaf Market. And I think it was quite a touchstone for the community, and of course it exposed the total poverty of the Citizens Police Review Board under the chair of Bill, what is his name? He was a dentist, and he did nothing, as did the board, in terms of demanding any independent investigation or undertaking it. Although it was a lethal shooting, it was the occasion when you'd want an independent investigation and public hearings. And similarly, Bill Christie was his name. And similarly, under the current administration, although some of us have suggested this matter be revisited, particularly policies the police department uses in its use of lethal force, we have seen no action from Chair Arnie Leff or even liberal members Sandy Brown and Becky Blythe, and certainly not from the more conservative members. And what these people say, Arnie Leff specifically, is, oh, I don't have the votes, and so there's no point in bringing it up because it would just fail. Well, of course, this argument ignores the fact that a discussion of an issue may get you the votes, and it certainly will get you the public attention. I'm sure the Sentinel will be covering it, however hostily and critically. And it's interesting, there was a controversy around SCAN, and how I recently have been declared persona non grata in SCAN headquarters. I've been barred from SCAN headquarters because I was looking through binders at SCAN headquarters without the SCAN coordinator being there, although as far as I knew there was nothing wrong with that. He didn't make the meeting that he might have come to on that fatal Wednesday, October 4th, and I was then told by the two other people in the office I couldn't be sitting at his desk looking through the binders, and they later claimed I was rifling the files, which was not true. But the Citizens Police Review Board information that SCAN had from the early 90s, the SCAN support was for a much stronger board, and really that's what we need. We need an oversight body that actually has disciplinary powers, investigative powers, subpoena power. Actually, the current board does have theoretically investigative and subpoena powers, and public hearing powers it hasn't even used. I guess most significantly, we need a citizenry that is really going to take action on these issues and bring the matter to city council, as was done in great numbers in the summer of 1992 when Officer Lauren Baker, now Sergeant Baker, or Butchie Baker as he's known, was called out by 9 or 10 women who accused him of sexual harassment as he searched them, and improper processes there, repeated improper processes. City Council had an investigatory committee that was formed under the pressure of the many people that came to City Council, but the next time, when there were very few people there, of course, they disbanded the committee and said instead that they would be working on a police review board. That's what Kennedy said, and of course, Kennedy didn't get that board online for 2 more years, and when it did, of course, it was a rubber stamp toy poodle type board, both because of the fact that it had been institutionally weakened. It didn't have automatic investigation of serious complaints. It only had investigation if the city manager allowed it, and only if the board demanded it, and that has only happened in one case, and that investigation has been closed down. I should say it has been allowed, but it has been stamped secret. That's the investigation of the May 22nd, 1999 police misconduct against the protesters protesting the Democratic fundraiser in the Yugoslavian bombing. So we have an election coming up. We have a sleeping band forum tonight that's happening at Loudoun Nelson Center. Starts at 7, runs to 10, possibly 9. I'm a little unclear as to when it's going to end. Everybody's invited, particularly those who want to take an active role. I'm curious to see who shows up. I'm inviting you there, and I believe that Jim is also throwing a subsequent meeting on Sunday for those of you who really are active in the organizing field in this matter, or who want to be. That's going to be from 2 to 5 at Loudoun Nelson Center this Sunday. That'll be after, it'll be right before the elections. But again, the elections require simply a vote. They don't require a great amount or expenditure of energy, though there are a number of people, I guess, putting time into the campaigns. The Homeless Working Group did really quite a good service, I think, for the community interested in issues around civil rights for the homeless. They actually held 6 or 7 hours worth of hearings. You might call them hearings. They invited all the 15 city council candidates for the Santa Cruz City Council to come and speak to them. Most of them showed up. Some of them only briefly, like Kennedy. Some ducked out completely, like Hernandez and Stewart. But most of the other ones, Riley also ducked out, showed up at least for a time. I'm going to play you some of the discussion to give you an idea, not so much of what the candidates said, which is always questionable and didn't really give us, I think, a firm basis in which to proceed. The candidates' record, of course, is more important than what they're saying during the election campaign. But it's useful to have their words on tape, and it's useful to have them put down their positions, and that was, I think, an important action taken by the Homeless Working Group. And I, for those who don't know what the Homeless Working Group is, it's a group that usually meets every Friday between 3 and 5 at the Chamber of Commerce, whose headquarters are at the Holiday Inn. That's Michael Schmidt's territory. He's the CEO for the area Chamber of Commerce. What is the Homeless Working Group? A group of would-be radicals doing associating with a supposedly conservative Chamber of Commerce CEO, Michael Schmidt? Well, it's kind of strange. In Santa Cruz, the grass grows from the sky, and the trees head for the middle of the earth. I mean, it's a strange territory, because Michael Schmidt, since January, has done more to push homeless issues than anybody on the city council. And he has done more than any social service providers that I know of. And I won't say he's done more than activists like David Silva or myself or Becky Johnson or James Ney or many other people, Bernard Klitzner, who've been putting in, I would have to say, hundreds of hours of time on this issue. But he has gone to hostile groups. He has argued with them. He has gone to the Chamber of Commerce and gotten it to support safe sleeping areas. He has gone to the police chief and urged him, and actually exposed Chief Belcher for forced him to say, no, I won't let homeless people sleep in my parking lot because it's not secure enough at night. That is an actual statement that was made. You cannot sleep in the parking lot number 10 near Hobie's restaurant, or near the bank, near the River Street, Front Street area, because they don't have a sprinkler system on the top floor. series of claims and excuses by authorities to stop any safe sleeping zones by the homeless. But Schmidt has not given up. Now, this 3-to-5 meeting is not going to be happening tomorrow or the next week because Michael Schmidt has some sort of other training sessions he has to use the space for. However, he has agreed to have a special meeting tomorrow morning for all you early birds at 7:15 at a Tastings restaurant. You probably have to bring your own coffee money. I'll kick in for coffee if people can't find the money to come. And if you're up that early, that's where I'm going to be tomorrow morning at 7:15. And we're going to be talking about the latest Dolphin Lee debacle, this special Tuesday meeting they had at City Council where they literally gave the Dolphin to Mercy Charities, excuse me, not just as a management for a period of time, not just pending a project which would have to be looked over very carefully to see if it had acceptable relocation provisions and a replacement housing provision for the 240-odd people there at the Dolphin. No, they just said, Mercy Charities, here's $1.5 million. You can buy this property right now. We want you to buy it. We, the city, don't want to buy it. And the question, big question was, of course, why? Why give it to Mercy Charities? And the answer that Cecil Cirillo gave me was, it's quicker that way. And we got the advice from our attorney, Brent Hawkins, in Sacramento to do it that way. That's the redevelopment agency's front man, the genius behind the Beach South of Laurel plan that this city rejected, Brent Hawkins. Anyway, we'll talk more about that. But Schmidt will be having this meeting tomorrow at 7:15 in the morning. For those who are interested, that's an Ocean Street Holiday Inn Tastings restaurant. It's a little restaurant inside the Holiday Inn. And anybody's welcome to come. And if you can't get there, and I know it's pretty early for most of us, do give a call to 423-HUFF, and we'll try and give you an update, 423-4833. And I'll also be available on the air to talk about the meeting on Sunday between 11 and 1:30 when this show, Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, returns. And this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And I invite you to stay with us. We're going to hear now some of the Homeless Working Group's interview of Dick DeBrava, who is a candidate pretty well-funded, who's been putting out some rather nasty ads in the Sentinel. You may have seen them. They are Why I Oppose Ending the Sleeping Ban ads. He's actually put two of them in there. He's the only candidate who's really specifically put an ad in the paper talking about this. And to his credit, the ads are not to his credit, but to his credit, he's always been quite upfront about his opposition to any change in the sleeping ban. Instead, he wants to throw money into a homeless czar, as I describe it, and throw a lot of money into a centralized organization that will somehow deal with all these problems in an effective way, shelter problems and employment problems and medical problems and transportation problems. And, you know, that has a nice sound to it. But in terms of addressing long-standing issues that almost everybody and his mother have weighed in on, to wit, making it illegal to sleep at night when there's no other place to go, which is what Santa Cruz law does at present, DeBrava has no real clear explanation as to where his head's at, except I say this, that he wants to placate West Side conservatives and conservatives in Tanner Heights and Paso Tiempo, and that he's simply interested in winning an election, and this is how he sees how he's going to do it. Now, he has never responded to my emails on this, but you do hear him talking about this and other issues at this homeless working group, and let's tune in on what he's got to say.
Around with these little groups here and these little groups there, because they all cost money, and in my words, they don't do much. So let's get this money and get it here where it can be a clout. It's a critical mass that we need to get together. I don't see the fact that if you have this little group here and this group there, it's sort of like, I know Robert doesn't want to hear me say this, but it's a band-aid approach. Let's get the clout so you can sit there with power and money and say, this is what we're going to do.
Give them the clout or give them the
nout. Whichever. I think this is the frustrating part, Dick, is what they've actually done is what we usually do in these situations. We turn it over to middle and lower level staffers in different agencies and departments in the county and city governments who actually have no political clout. Then by the time they bring their report up to whoever it is, the Board of Supervisors or the City Council, then it's so diluted and it actually has, or if they actually can do anything, but the people that have the voices and the leadership, in my mind, need to be on something this serious. If we see it as a serious problem, which it should be taken, it's like, to me, the metro base is a serious problem, and we need to look at a more strategic approach to that issue, and all the rest of these
things. This is Michael Schmidt talking.
Get the people that actually, like we did with Vision Santa Cruz, we got the movers and shakers and the people that actually do things to sit around the table and agree to it. Instead, their continuum of care approach is to try to put it into a deal where we'll just get more money to programs.
So you're saying
in my opinion, they suboptimized a great opportunity.
I think it slows down. I mean, I've seen many large organizations that do that, and they do it because it slows down the process. It's my own personal DeBrava feeling. I've seen it done. I've used it myself in the large corporation I worked in. And you say, okay, we're going to let you do this. If you're really interested, somebody steps up and becomes the guru. And he has the clout, and he reports to the people who are the board of supervisors, the city councils, whichever. And everybody has to march to his drummer. And I see something like that happening with a homeless task force or a homeless committee sitting here helping this whole thing. And that's where it goes. One guy, name the guy. Make him a homeless expert from someplace who knows how to handle these things. Let him have advice from the homeless committee. And let him drive this through and get his own power base going. We don't have a power base today. I don't see it anywhere here. That's my opinion. Can I make that happen by myself? I don't know, but I can sure try to make that happen. And I see that as an example of many things in this city, not just the homeless. It's the affordable housing, the same damn thing. We've got money sitting here in a redevelopment agency, and Seal Cirello does that, and we have money sitting here in Eileen Fogarty's pocket. They're doing some things here. Put them together, and let's get some people working together on this affordable housing thing. I mean, take a look at San Jose, what they're doing.
10,000 new housing units.
They got, Ron Gonzalez has got a committee, and the committee's got money. They got 14 million bucks to work with. They're going to put 6,000 affordable houses out there. Okay, now we're not going to be able to get 14 million bucks, but we can model the same program and get something going. And I advocate, and I would, if I have a chance, even if I don't get a chance, I'm still going to advocate it, that you got to start land banking here. I know it sounds sort of capitalistic, but if you don't buy the land now, you're never going to build workforce housing even. Somebody who's making $40,000 a year isn't able to buy a house.
And you're listening to Dick DeBrava at the Homeless Working Group I think it's late September, early October. A lot of nice words here, and there are some people who have a lot of confidence in DeBrava. Gordon Pusser is one of them. There are numerous people who think he's a strong candidate, but I don't. I have to judge. We had three key issues which the Huff brought up for candidates. One was the sleeping ban. Would you not just end the sleeping ban by striking sections A and also the blanket ban section B of the camping ordinance, but would you do so immediately after getting into office, and would you attempt to do so even if you were alone? And the only person people really answered that one, yes. Well, we got some good yeses early that seemed to sort of fade out. Scott Bugenstall said yes initially and then faded away on it. Steve Argue has taken a strong yes position and has stuck to it. Jake Fathy took an early yes, backtracked, and then went back to yes. Bonnie Moore took a yes position on that. Second core issue that we had was police review, community control of police. Would you move to establish real community control of police, not just by some little toy poodle board, but by slashing the budget, by establishing real controls over the police, by maybe requiring police officers to live in Santa Cruz, by having some real community input into police policies, things of this sort, and didn't get a clear indication of what folks thought on that. The Homeless Working Group actually sent out a questionnaire 3 weeks ago, and the only thing we got back was from Peter Cook. Peter Cook has a bad position on the sleeping ban and a good position on the Dolphin Lee issue. That was our third issue. How do you stand on the affordable housing issue in terms of the Dolphin Lee and making sure that before you tear down people's homes that they have places to go to and they are going to be guaranteed housing in the supposed project that is coming up? And Cook, Moore, and Argue actually were the only three who showed up at the Fiesta and at the forum, at the televised forum last Saturday, and dealt with these issues publicly. Dubrava is a really kind of a notorious example. I talked to one of his supporters last night and explained that Dubrava promised, and maybe on this tape, that he would come on October 10th at the city council meeting when the city council was scheduled to purchase the Dolphin property over the objections of numerous community members, people at the Lee, some Dolphin tenants who said, don't buy that Dolphin property unless you're giving them guarantees, because the only management company you've set up to look at it is to manage it is Mercy Charities Housing, that has an agenda that will not protect the housing of the people who currently live there. And Dubrava promised he would come and speak out at City Council on October 10th. He was nowhere to be found. He didn't email. He didn't write. He didn't send a representative. He didn't respond to our emails requesting information on it. And he also didn't show up 2 weeks later when the city moved to demolish the Rex Court properties, again part of this infamous Dolphin Lee project, which is creating less housing than it's destroying, across the street from the Dolphin. And you're destroying a housing that could be used, that you're purchasing it from the Seaside Company after they've evicted a bunch of people and let the property deteriorate. And instead of using the refurbishing the deteriorated property or looking at some kind of a report, getting a report as to how much it would cost to refurbish it, how much it would cost to demolish it, what the difference in those two prices would be, which would be the best alternative, the city just went straight ahead and did that, and Dubrava said nothing, did nothing, paid no attention to the issue, and broke his word to the Homeless Working Group. And then, of course, most recently on Tuesday, when the city did this complete twist-a-roo, and instead of giving Mercy Charities Housing the management contract over the Dolphin Apartments, instead it gave them $1.5 million to buy the Dolphin Apartments outright. Was Dick Dubrava there? No, he was not. Bonnie Moore was there. That was it. So let's hear some more of this Homeless Working Group discussion. It's interesting to hear the ideas, but what you have to remember is, if you're dealing with a person who doesn't keep his or her promises, that's the important issue, not the fine words that are being spoken.
How the government doesn't step in with public funds or private funds and leverage the money to buy land, that freezes basically the cost of housing.
Because I understand that. Because the rate.
Because the land is what's expensive.
Well, let's talk about a particular project. We're concerned about the Dolphin Lee $12.5 million affordable housing.
What do you think about that
project?
Well, okay. I'm going to go. I think when I went down there and I looked around, I took a few tours down there.
When did you go down?
Oh, about a month ago or so. Jane Barr. Jane, Phil, and I.
Were, Barr or something?
Whatever. I call her Jane so I don't get in trouble.
Yeah.
But I went down there and looked around. And to me, if we want to get serious, we need to build something without tearing anything down. Okay, now let me talk about the pie in the sky first, and then we got to get down to reality. The vision that I have is to try to get some land to at least build something equivalent to either the Dolphin or the Lee. I don't know which one goes first. I don't even know if they go yet. I shouldn't have said goes first, but we need to build something there. Not across the street, but next to it. There's some land there, I think.
There's a parking lot right next to the Lee.
When I built ranches.
Right, and what you do is you build something there, and you say, okay, guys, which one of these two buildings wants to move first, the Dolphin or the Lee? Let's move people from here to here. Then you decide, what do you want to do? You want to bulldoze this thing down, or do you want to reconstruct it, refurbish it? That's a choice. It's a money choice. Which is better?
So let's talk about
at least you've saved all that relocation cost.
Let's talk about the specifics of this. Because the specifics are that the land next door is owned by the Seaside Company. And I think that Michael here actually investigated whether he at first thought that perhaps they might be amenable to selling it. And then found out, it was land across the street, so they could do the Third Street realignment crap and cut off the street. But they're really interested. They didn't say that. But that's the opinion of some of us, if that's what they want to do. They want to have, you know, Dolphin Lee, Pink Palace, as it's called, across the street, block the street, set up a project.
Actually, that's the story that I got was because of the beach area plan, we're going to lose 90 parking places moving around from Beach Street and the surrounding area. And that provides them with a little more parking. And if they lose even more parking, that was the big reason. Charlie told me it was his boogaloo. He said, if I had the parking, it wouldn't be an issue for me to give up this parking lot. But he said, I'm losing 90 spaces, and they claim they're going to get me 120 at the depot site, but God knows when that's going to happen. They're going to start incrementally next year taking those spaces away. And he said, I need every bit of parking. He said, get more time.
So that's Michael Schmidt explaining why Charlie Canfield, the head of the Seaside Company, is not interested in parting with the vacant parking lot, which many of us have said is a good place to build affordable housing, next to the Lee property. Or if Charlie won't part with it, maybe it's time for the city to eminent domain it, rather than to use these eminent domain threats to go after the Dolphin and the Rex Court, and perhaps very soon the Lee Apartments. Lee Apartments have stood out. They were the original folks who organized against a project without guarantees, and when they demanded it and took over the leadership, the city suspended the city's relocation advisory committee, the official committee that was working on this, in which the tenants had a majority, refused to hold meetings, and cut the Lee tenants out completely in a very cynical, obvious move to eliminate activists who were telling the city that they weren't going to have their homes destroyed in the name of a pretty picture of some future affordable housing project that only some people would be allowed to come into. So we're listening to Dick Dubrava. This is sort of an example of the homeless working group talking to a political candidate. You can hear least what supposedly is going on in the mind, or what he's sharing with the electorate about his thoughts. Dubrava is not as much of a front runner, in my view, as Ed Porter, Emily Riley, who never came to a meeting, and Ed Porter, who also... Actually, Porter did come to meetings, and we probably should be listening to him, since he's more likely to be the candidate who will be victorious. But limitations of time, space, and available tape give us Dubrava at this moment. And it's interesting to hear the kinds how Dubrava deals with these issues or doesn't deal with these issues. Again, how a particular largely conservative set of candidates, however much they build themselves as progressive and however wildly left the Sentinel likes to describe these candidates as being, is less important than, and I think this is the key issue, and I hope that this comes up tonight at the forum being organized by Jim Costner at the Loudoun Nelson Center, which starts, in just about 15 minutes down there, is how can the community organize to bring the sleeping ban and other issues to the council, whoever is sitting on that council? That's going to really be the question. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, and I'm Bathrop's peer Robert Norse. Lots of interesting stories coming out of L.A., by the way, Los Angeles. There's, of course, this infamous shooting, which has even hit the Sentinel, where an actor was shot by the police. I'm going to read the long version of this story because I find it interesting. This is the police account of what happened, and of course, one wonders if it's worth reading. Let's read a little bit anyway. Police released details of party shooting October 31st. Violence. Slain actor had a very realistic gun replica, Chief Park says. The Los Angeles Police Department on Monday rallied around an officer who shot and killed a man at a weekend Halloween costume party, saying that he too was a victim of a tragic set of circumstances. Authorities say Anthony Dwayne Lee was pointing an authentic-looking rubber replica of a .357 Magnum semi-automatic Desert Eagle at police when he was shot. It was not clear where Lee, an up-and-coming actor, got the replica. The officer, Terrell Hopper, fired 9 shots at Lee, striking him several times early Saturday as Lee stood in a ground-floor bedroom of a Benedict Canyon mansion known as the Castle. Hopper, 27, was investigating a noise complaint and was making his way through the backyard of the home when he saw Lee pointing the gun at him through a window. Police said, "When you get something that realistic, I don't think any of you would ask the officer to take an extra second to determine whether it was a rubber gun," Police Chief Bernard C. Parks told reporters at an afternoon news conference standing next to a real Desert Eagle in the replica police said Lee had when he was shot. The two were almost indistinguishable except for a slight glint from the real metal gun. Such cases, Parks said, you put an officer in a very tough situation in a split second to try to determine whether it's a replica or a real gun. I think that's the real tragedy. Lee, Parks added, had the gun pointed in a very direct location at Hopper, and from close range, when the officer unholstered his service weapon and opened fire. The chief said Hopper had no time to shout a warning. The shooting occurred so instantaneously that the officers had no chance to even make an audible sound, Parks said. I'm going to interrupt this because you don't find in the story the fact that, this is a tall black man, that there are other officers in costume at this party. That is to say, there are other individuals in costume as police officers. The claim is being made, and you'll hear it later, that the man inside who was killed by police with 9 shots, I'm not sure how many of which struck him, could probably not have even known there was an officer outside the window because of the light situation. He wouldn't have seen that officer. And that it was a kind of a festive affair where people were engaging in costumish type activities, Halloween type activities. Sounds like such a clear cover-up of a situation and defense of an indefensible policy that it, that's how it sounds. And it's the kind of thing that you hear repeatedly. When I was listening to the V-Man last night or the night before talk about a similar case in Minnesota where a naked man, naked, with no weapons whatsoever, was shot in the back 3 times and apparently probably paralyzed, if not for life, for a long time, in a Minnesota case. And then the officer claimed he was reaching for his gun. We had another case in Mountain View recently of this. And, of course, the Happy John Dine case revolved here in Santa Cruz, and the anniversary is coming up again on November 12th, around a supposed toy gun that D.A. Art Danner, Police Chief Steve Belcher, and I guess some of the officers claimed was being pointed in a combat stance at the officers when they screeched to a stop at the bus stop where they killed Dine with 2 shots to the chest. Of course, none of the non-police witnesses, and there were, 14 or so of them, if you kind of tally up all the stories you get, saw anything of the kind. They didn't see a weapon out. They didn't see a weapon pointed. They didn't see a combat stance. Now, a toy gun was found near Dine, but there were those who claimed that Officer Over reached into Dine's clothing and pulled something out and threw it on the ground. And I don't know if that was, I wasn't there. I didn't see it. But, of course, there was no independent investigation, so we'll never know. And in most police departments, I would venture to say, I haven't heard of a police department where there is any real accountability in this country. With the drug war in full swing, something, by the way, that our candidates for city council don't seem to want to talk about, much less do anything about, with the exception, perhaps, of Steve Argue, you have massive support of the police department, a blank check, an incentive for illegal behavior, an intensification of the violence. Bad stuff. Reading more from the story from the LA Times, Hopper's partner, Natalie Humphreys, may have been behind him and did not see the shooting, police said. Police records and sources indicate that Saturday's incident was the first time Hopper, a 3-year veteran, has been involved in a shooting. Hopper is devastated by the incident, according to Deputy Chief David Kalish, commanding officer of the LAPD's West Bureau, which includes the Benedict Canyon party site. I personally spoke to the officer, and he felt his life was in danger, Kalish said. He felt like he was about to be shot with the semi-automatic pistol. The comments by Parks and other officials marked the first detailed response by the LAPD to the shooting, which is drawing international attention and second-guessing upon the beleaguered LAPD. You can hear the bias in the story even as I read it, the pro-police bias, as it struggles with the unrelated Rampart officer corruption scandal. There are 3 presumptions in the sentence already. Second-guessing, beleaguered, and unrelated Rampart's corruption struggle. The fact that
it's not at all unrelated that there's this massive corruption in the police department, and that in fact you're still getting a continual corruption in the police department, that this is simply an indication of general corruption throughout the LAPD, and you're only getting a focus on certain areas of it. The inference that it's unrelated is unshown, is unproven. Unrelated Rampart officer corruption scandal and a consent decree with the U.S. Justice Department over its use of force and other problems, such as perjury.
Murder, framing innocent people, sending innocent people to jail for years. But this is, of course, reduced by the LA Times to the phrase, its use of force and other problems. It sounds like this story was written by the police department, the LAPD. The LAPD disclosures were based on a preliminary inquiry, and Parks and others stressed that they had just begun a thorough and aggressive internal investigation. One top police official who will be investigating the shooting said, officers are trained that if someone points a gun at you, you fire in immediate defense of life. But it's very easy to be a Monday morning quarterback, and that is something we have to avoid doing. Of course, there's no mention as to why the officer didn't just jump out of the way or... He fires 9 times in a crowd. I don't know that it was a crowd. It's hard to tell for sure, but that's what I get from the context of the other stories. Continuing the story, despite the disclosure, several major questions remain unanswered, including whether Lee was in costume, how he was acting at the time of the shooting, where his wounds were, and how far he was from Hopper when he was shot. Already, a district attorney's team is investigating the shooting as required to determine whether the officers violated any criminal laws. LAPD's Inspector General Jeffrey Eglash is also investigating. The disclosures offered a marked contrast to descriptions of the face-off between Lee and Hopper from people at the party. Critics of the police, including friends of Lee, the dead man, and neighbors of the party house, question whether Hopper and Humphreys helped precipitate the shooting by going into the backyard instead of waiting by the front door for the host of the party. On Monday, City Councilwoman Jackie Goldberg echoed these concerns. Goldberg, an outspoken critic of the LAPD, called on Eglash and the police commission to launch thorough investigations into the tactics used by Hopper and Humphreys. If the call to police was that someone was being raped, you could understand things could happen badly, Goldberg said. But this was a complaint about noise. No one should be dead. Parks sought to deflect such criticism, saying officers generally use common sense in dealing with noise complaints. And I'm going to skip the rest of this because it simply just reads like a police press release. They're trying to say that, there are lots of cases where replica guns are a very serious problem. We want to make sure people don't do that. Despite the innocent nature of the party, we don't want the people to let their guard down here. Dangerous situations occur in noise complaints. I mean, there's a whole bunch of statements which are just endlessly reassuring and make one, in fact, even more suspicious that there's wrongdoing happening here. Monday night at a candlelight vigil in memory of Lee outside the West L.A. police station, about 200 people gathered around a makeshift Buddhist shrine covered with white candles. His Buddhist philosophy was about the individual transformation of humankind, said Miran Willis, 35, a fellow actor and Buddhist. He probably would want to have everyone start chanting. At that, low chanting filled the night air. Several people emphasized they were not there to lay blame, but to celebrate Lee's life. I know that Anthony would be extremely sympathetic to the person who injured him. I knew he would understand the complexities, the accidents, and the ironies. I will bet you dollars to donuts. There were plenty of people at that funeral, at that celebration, who felt the police department needed to be curbed very badly, and that they would want to use this as an instance of severe police misconduct that hopefully would stop the next person from getting killed rather than simply forgive and forget. This is, again, we're looking at showing how the police, pro-police propaganda just infiltrates the media here. Here is, however, a response from the LA Times, which was apparently an editorial. Were bullets the only way? The LAPD says its preliminary look into the police killing early Sunday of Van Nuys actor Anthony Duane Lee, 39, suggests no tactical errors by the officer who fired the fatal shots. While we make no judgment on any criminality in this tragic event, it's clear it shows at least a shocking lack of training in how to avoid the circumstances that led to the death. Once again, as in the LAPD's fatal shooting of the homeless Margaret Laverne Mitchell last year, this is a woman wielding a screwdriver, a homeless woman, that was shot by police with her shopping cart about a year ago. Another infamous case. The department seems to have put itself in the position of defending the indefensible. Officers Terriel Hopper and Natalie Humphreys were responding to a complaint about a loud Halloween party in Benedict Canyon. Lee, a guest, was apparently standing near a bedroom window. Hopper has told the department that Lee pointed what appeared to be a semi-automatic handgun in his direction. Hopper said he feared for his life. Police said Lee was shot 9 times. So he was shot 9 times, according to this story. I thought there were 9 shots fired, maybe only a few of which hit him, but 9 times. Police Chief Bernard C. Park said Hopper did not have time to shout a warning to Lee to drop what the officer thought was a weapon. He also said the two officers had gone to the front door to seek out the party host, and then, at the request of guests, had gone toward the rear of the structure by way of the yard. Among the many things that are still unclear about the incident is whether Lee was even able to see the police officer through the window, much less intentionally point what turned out to be a realistic rubber replica of a gun at him. Neither is it clear whether Lee knew that Hopper was a real LAPD officer. He might have taken him for another guest in police costume. The LAPD's own 1999 Police Officer's Manual states that police should use only the reasonable amount of physical force which is necessary on any particular occasion for achieving a police objective. The costume party may have been confusing, but it is hard to regard this shooting into a house full of partygoers as minimal force. The LAPD has been quick to blame the horrific mistake on the availability of realistic replicas of guns and on dangers faced by police in previous calls to party disturbances. Of course, those are serious problems, but not the fundamental ones. The basic question is unfortunately familiar. Are officers appropriately trained and prepared in the use of lethal force? The city's police commission, the department's inspector general, the county DA, and the LAPD itself must delve far deeper to explain fully the awful shooting that cost the actor his life and devastated many, including Officer Hopper. And that's again the LAPD, or the LA Times, on the 31st. And there have, of course, recently been other stories coming out about that, since we're now on the 2nd of November. The LAPD has been filled with stories. And one of those is hopefully here as I thumb through my papers in search of it. But there was actually a small version of that story in today's Sentinel, I believe, about, or yesterday's, about how Johnny Cochran is taking the case for the family to prosecute the officer, or at least to get some sort of civil damages. And I may go into that case further on Sunday. Here's another interesting story. A federal appeals court ruled that a criminal defendant is not necessarily entitled to a lawyer who stays awake during his or her trial. It would be funny if it weren't so shameful. The ruling came in the case of Texas inmate Calvin J. Burdine, sentenced to death for a 1983 murder, and it further heightens the state's reputation for an assembly line death apparatus so efficient that neither gross legal incompetence nor exculpatory evidence can slow its gears. During Burdine's trial, his court-appointed attorney often fell asleep at the defense table, according to jurors and the court clerk. In one instance, the clerk noted, attorney Joe Frank Cannon's head was bowed, and he was asleep for at least 10 minutes. Cannon was also either dozing or daydreaming while prosecutors cross-examined Burdine, a grilling that ran to 72 pages of transcript. Cannon said nothing, not even objecting, when Burdine was asked clearly prejudicial questions about his sexual orientation. Cannon, who has since died, also slept during the trial of another defendant who has already been executed. A federal district judge overturned Burdine's sentence as a no-brainer noting that reversal should be automatic when the defendant's lawyer sleeps during his trial. But a three-member panel of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans didn't see it that way. The appeals panel insisted that it was not, quote, condoning sleeping by a capital counsel during a capital murder trial, a statement that must be of cold comfort to those among Burdine's fellow inmates on Texas's death row, whose attorneys came to court drunk, unprepared, or uninterested in their cases. But with reasoning that makes a mockery of constitutional due process guarantees, the panel concluded that it is impossible to determine, instead only to speculate, that counsel sleeping actually hurt Burdine's case. This outrageous ruling came as Americans seemed to be rethinking their once rock-solid support for capital punishment. The growing sophistication of DNA testing and new attention to trial abuses, such as those in Burdine's case, have prompted many to ask themselves whether innocent men and women have been put to death in Texas and other states since the Supreme Court reinstated capital punishment in 1976, despite assurances by Texas Governor George W. Bush and others. Not to mention that, of course, Al Gore also favors capital punishment. Burdine's current lawyer is asking for a rehearing by a larger panel of Fifth Circuit judges, and failing that, he will seek review by the U.S. Supreme Court. To let this ruling stand would be an abomination. This, too, from the L.A. Times on 31st of October. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm your host, Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norris. And call-in number here, in case you want to join any of this discussion, is 427-3772, 427-FRSC. Well, I was traveling a couple of months ago back from the Democratic National Coronation, the protests against the coronation, actually, which is what I went down there for, and I went through Santa Barbara on the way back, where I had spent a year working with the Legal Defense Center, again on similar issues like we have in Santa Cruz, the sleeping ban. Santa Barbara also has a sleeping ban. And I ran into activist Bob Hansen. And Bob has been active down there longer than I have. He's been active for two decades. And I'm trying to find the point on the tape where I want to join Bob, because I think the interview we have here is a good one. He actually was part of the Santa Barbara protests that blocked Highway 101 and established the right of homeless people to vote. Before 1985, homeless people who didn't have a residence, and homeless people almost by definition don't, were not allowed to vote. Now, of course, if you're homeless, you can register at a place that you don't necessarily pay rent for or even necessarily pick up mail for. You can register at almost a grate, like if you're in a city where there are such things, or a tree. The fig tree in Santa Barbara was where people were registering to vote. And you could vote. But Hansen and other activists in Santa Barbara are responsible for that situation happening. And I came through Santa Barbara to get an update, and I did. But first, this musical break.
I've always hated Blockbuster.
Target.
McDonald's.
The Gap.
Pepsi.
Nike.
IBM.
Starbucks.
Not quite so much. If I'm not boycotting at least three oil companies, I start to feel out of touch. I wouldn't be seen in Nordstrom's or any such. And I hate Walmart. I don't like whips. I don't like chains. I don't go chopping up my neighbor's brains. Don't really even like shopping except at the flea market. And I hate Walmart. Now you may wonder, what's all this fuss? If you don't like the train, take the bus. Found religion, and just between us, I hate Walmart. If you didn't hear the story, well, here's how it is. Big companies sell the low cost, drive mom and pop out of biz. Pretty soon all over the land, one big square store, identical brand, and that's why I hate Walmart. Used to be you drive around Stop in on three or four towns, encounter different sights and sounds, different if not unique. Different accent, different smell, different things to buy and sell. Now it's all Taco Bell. I hate Walmart. Roll juice, dip and wine, you drive slow, relax your mind. Never knew what you'd find around the next bend. But now the freeway goes so straight, it go right past the pearly gate. I don't feel human, I feel like freight. I hate Walmart. I like to roam, I like to greet individuals on the street. You always know the one you meet is one of a kind. But more and more they seem to me reflection of something on TV. When we're all alike, nobody's free. I hate Walmart. I boycott Burger King, I boycott Newt Gingrich, I boycott everything which I've seen advertised. I used to go out for dinner in a diner, now they say fast food is finer, but it tastes like it fell out of an airliner's enough to make you weep. I don't like board games, I don't like brand names, they make inflated claims, they're full of bleep. Everyone I meet is a high-tech teller, wants to sell me a digital potato peeler, and I don't like Garrison Keillor, cause he's so white. Turn on my radio dial, like to hear something new once in a while, but it's the same old crap in a brand new style, it's audio rape. Still I try to pick and choose, I turn the dial, but always lose. Once in a while, if you're lucky, maybe one little rhythm and blues, and that's why God made tape. Used to be we wore beads and bells, made our own clothes in our own way. Now we all wear uniforms at Hard Rock Cafe. We're in a state of sartorial decay, and that's why I hate Walmart. There's a pretty spot to pave it over, put a clover leaf over a four-leaf clover. Cliffs of Dover, it never fails. Hope you like this song. Thanks a bunch. Could go on, but I gotta go eat lunch. If you didn't like it, I've got a hunch.
You work in sales.
Don't grow your own, make your own. Be careful what you own. Develop non-shopping to an art. And whatever.
Dave Lippmann, I Hate Walmart. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Your call-in number to reach us on air is 427-3772. To reach Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, off air, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And to reach the radio station generally by voicemail means is 427-4523. I'm Robert Norse. I'll be with you till 8 o'clock when I'm going to dash over to Loudon Nelson and join the Sleeping Band festivities. That's Jim Costner back from San Jose, I guess is where he's been for the last few months, doing some activist work over there, is organizing a new campaign against the Sleeping Band. He's going to begin with a forum tonight at Loudon Nelson Center. It's actually on right now. Started at 7, goes till 9 or 10. I invite you to join he and I and a bunch of us over there. Hey, bring your radio and you can... it gets boring, you can turn on Bathrop Spears Broadsides again. Just got a call from the V-Man, Vinny, Vicious Vinny as I call him. He's going to be doing a special hour before the... now, I hope I'm getting the time right. Maybe I can get Vinny to call in and announce this. I thought he said Sunday from 10 to 11, but he might have said Saturday. Let me take a look at the schedule here. It looks like Sunday. That's V-Man Live, 10 to 11 on Sunday. He's going to have council candidates flooding the studio. We're going to see how many council candidates we can fit in the studio with Scott Kennedy. It's going to be pretty difficult. Scott Kennedy, Michael Hernandez, and me in one room is enough to, make you want to move to another room, maybe to another building. But in any case, he's only had three confirmations so far, but he's hoping to have more. He's going to be ringing and dinging and getting the candidates on the line. And he invites everybody to listen in Sunday at 10 o'clock. And it's a good time to tune in 10 o'clock in the morning, because you're going to be voting in 3 days after that if you haven't already voted. I know a lot of people have cast absentee ballots, but if you haven't already voted, maybe even if you have, just so you can get in a few licks at these folks and ask a few pertinent questions or impertinent questions, that's Sunday at 10 o'clock on the V-Man Show, Council Candidates Special. He wants to give the city a chance to really talk to the candidates. At the forums, you know, you get, if you're lucky, you get a minute to ask a question, and that usually doesn't happen. So here's a chance to publicly demand candidates take real positions and do so. So tune in 10 o'clock on Sunday, and then at 11 you can join my show. I go from 11 to 1:30, Bathrop Spears Broadside, so a double treat. We can have Vinny do our work for us, get the candidates' positions all laid out, and then we can rake them over the coals. And then, of course, later in the day, you can go to Jim Costner's second organizational meeting on the sleeping band, if you like. That's from 2 to 5 in Loudoun Nelson Center. I can't stand long meetings myself, but you might just drop in, take a look, see what you think, and contribute a little in terms of maybe assessing how much time and energy you can put into that kind of a situation, because we are really going to need people willing to stand up against the sleeping ban in a more direct kind of way. We've had this silence for the last few months at City Council. We've had some talk among the council candidates, but of course, where that talk might have mattered, like bringing the matter to City Council and pressing the current City Council on the issue, rather than sort of making these vague promises and talking about safe sleeping zones, that hasn't happened. So, and the way that is going to happen is if people start, you know, lining up outside City Council doors, if they start engaging in massive puppet-like Seattle and Los Angeles and Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. style protests, where the city has no choice but to listen to the fact that civil rights are being cut off by a law that criminalizes people from sleeping at night. I mean, it's a no-brainer, folks. And it's becoming clearer and clearer to a broader and broader number of people that this is an indefensible law, and that this policy is indefensible. But unfortunately, it requires endless activity, endless activism until it's overturned. It's like segregation in the South. It's like discrimination in South Africa, where you have a whole class of people who are treated as less than human, less than decent, less than citizens, and that's what we have in Santa Cruz with homeless people. And it's pretty self-evident. And the solution is also self-evident. Enough people standing up to insist, not in our town. Kind of a reverse, not in our backyard. We aren't going to allow civil rights violations in our backyards, in our streets, in our police department, in our parks. No more human rights violations, thank you very much.
AT&T, Philip Morris, Microsoft, Enron, Citigroup, Bell Atlantic, Anheuser-Busch,
Sprint. These are just a handful of the 66 savvy corporations that have given over $50,000 to both George W. Bush and Al Gore. We don't think there's a difference, do you? We're happy with both candidates, aren't you?
Paid for by billionaires for Bush or Gore, because government should be by the corporations, of the corporations, and for the corporations. www.billionairesforbushorgore.com.
And that was a well-paid political announcement. This, again, is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. Call-in number 427-3772. The Homeless Services Center recently got a new kitchen. For those who have been kind of following City Council meetings, or maybe go out and eat occasionally at the Homeless Services Center, which has meals at 8 and at 4, and I'm going to talk about that in just a moment, but first, one of my many fans seems to be calling in. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, this is Scott.
Hey, Scott Graham. You're our absentee commentator. Where are you?
Oh, I'm sitting at home at the moment.
I see.
But I was just wondering, since, you know, you were talking about the local Santa Cruz City Council race, it might be worthwhile if you were to give your endorsement to this.
Well, actually, I did earlier in the evening.
Oh, I must have missed it.
Yeah, no, it's you missed that crucial endorsement. I endorse Scott Kennedy and Michael Hernandez. No, just kidding. I endorse.
You must have stock in the Lark Company, then.
I myself am pretty portly. I cannot attack an individual's girth without looking in a mirror and finding it's hard to look around myself. So, I don't know. I know, however, that the problem I have, of course, with Kennedy and Hernandez is they are a known quantity on the city council, and they have been bad on not only homeless issues, but on issues around police misconduct and issues around giving away the city to the Seaside Company.
Issues about public input.
Indeed, at city council, although I must say Mayor Sugar and the upcoming Mayor Fitzmaurice will probably be giving them quite a close race for their money.
Yeah. Well, they've been being tootled by Rotkin the last 2 years.
Well, you know, I mean, Rotkin is sort of the parliamentarian. The councilmember Rotkin has been in office, this is his fourth term, I guess.
Yeah, 16th year.
So he's very savvy in the ways of how to, you know, run Robert's Rules of Order and run the Santa Cruz City Council, and one can understand how, and some, it's tempting to look to him for guidance, fatally tempting. And I think you pointed this out to me, that Rotkin makes many of the motions instead of Sugar or Crone or Fitzmaurice or even Byers, and so doing, he has taken a control over the political process. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. That is the political process. Someone makes a motion, and that's what gets voted on. And by him being the maker of motions, he gets to frame the motion the way he wants it framed. And if people don't like that, even though they like what's being voted on, then they have to try to get amendments passed to the main motion. So he basically ends up controlling the council by being the one that makes the majority of the motions.
Yeah, that of course... Rotkin also has I think, been a major... certainly significantly cheerleader in trying to shut down public comment. And I know that we saw the shutdown of public comment in a meeting as recent as the noon special meeting 2 days ago, when the city council unanimously passed this incredible giveaway to Mercy Charities Housing. Do you want to talk about that at all?
Well, it's supposedly, the staff report said that it was a loan to Mercy Charities at 0% interest rate. And so instead of the city buying the Dolphin property, now all of a sudden Mercy's buying it with this loan from the city.
And of course, again, for those who don't know, Dolphin is the apartment complex which the city, through Mercy Charities Housing, has been talking about demolishing, along with property across the street, the Rex Court, and the adjacent Lee apartment property, to build a new, spanky, shiny, more clean, sanitary, and upbeat project which will house, will be more spacious for the people it houses. But of course, the problem is that
it won't house the same number of people.
And it also won't house the people that that are currently being dislodged.
Right.
So the city, I know, on October 10th moved to acquire the Dolphin. Then on the 24th, it moved to demolish the Rex Court, or at least to authorize that demolition officially by resolution. And now, 2 days ago, you're telling us that they moved to simply... They sort of changed horses again. What did they do 2 days ago?
Right. Now they're loaning this money to Mercy Charities at a 0% interest rate. And then what came up during the Tuesday meeting was that this isn't even really a loan, that it's going to eventually evolve into a grant. Mercy doesn't even have to make any payments on this loan of $1.5 million.
They're going to give $1.5 million to Mercy Charities Housing initially as a loan in order to purchase the Dolphin property. We knew that they had planned to set up Mercy Charities Housing at least as the interim management of this apartment building with the current people in it, in the current apartments as they are now, and we'd have been afraid that they're going to start telling people to leave and thin out those apartments, and that was a concern we had a couple of weeks ago, and we we suggest that people keep a real close eye on who is in the apartments and who gets evicted and start raising a hue and a cry if that happens. We suggest that people sign, who are in the Dolphin, go to the Mercy Charities Housing before the management transfers and say, look, we want you to agree that we're going to be able to stay on. And if Mercy Charities doesn't agree to that, they start publicizing the fact that Mercy Charities is planning not to keep the people on, as Mayor Sugar promised on October 17th to a crowd of Mercy Charities people, but will be letting people go or not letting people stay. And yet this latest turn of events is not only is the city was going to buy the property and then, you know, let Mercy manage it, now it's going to say to Mercy, here, we're not even going to touch the property, you get to buy it.
Right. I think this is a way of the city insulating themselves from any criticism if something bad happens. They can say, well, we don't own it, we don't manage it. You know, we are a low-income housing provider, though, so you'll have to take it up with them. And I think it's also, I mean, this time will tell, but I think it's also a loophole that's going to allow them to get out of paying out a lot of relocation money and having any guarantees whatsoever that once people leave this property, when they tear down the existing buildings, guarantees that they come back, I don't know if there is anything in state or federal law that will cover them because the city's no longer doing it. It's now this nonprofit organization that's doing it.
You know what I noticed, Scott, was that I noticed that before Mercy Charities, we had sort of two distinct phases that we had to contend with. One was Mercy Charities Housing acquiring management over the city-owned property, and then we had to make sure that they didn't tell people to leave because there were too many people in an apartment, or for some other specious reason, because we were afraid they'd be thinning out the apartments in anticipation of lessening the population so they could then present a relocation plan and a replacement housing plan, apparently required by law, that would be feasible. This is before.
It may not be required by law.
Well, I'm saying before October 31st, before the vote 2 days ago, this is what I was expecting. I was expecting to see Mercy Charities Housing first manage the property for a number of weeks or months and then say, okay, well, here's a plan to relocate this number of people. Here's a plan to build this new structure on the property which will allow this number of people to return. But now what we've got, I mean, they would have to go through, I think, two distinct steps, one to manage it as it is now and then to present a plan. Now, as I understand it, what they're doing is they've got the property. And I don't know that they have the same kinds of requirements on them to have this kind of very clear, we're going to be building as many units as we're destroying, that we're going to be letting people come back. Although, it has to be said that there are some statements in the contract with the city that have to do with the loan, which requires them to not to evict any lawful occupant. You want to talk about that?
Well, that was another concern that a number of us had, is what exactly they meant by lawful. And the city, by your prompting, Mike Rockin, the actual leader of the city council, I guess it was a real good idea on your part to actually talk to him instead of any other council member about it. But they actually did talk about what they meant by legal, although they didn't direct staff to include that in anywhere in writing.
You're talking about the phrase legal occupant, and we had the question,
right.
Does legal occupant mean in a let's say a unit where you have two families of five or six people each, all in one, you know, one small apartment, but only two people are on the lease? Does that mean just those two people? Does it mean all the 12 people living there? You know, who will be protected? And we were assured repeatedly by Elizabeth Vogel and Cecil Cirillo, and I suppose by Mike Rotkin, that it was the intention of the council to protect and define everyone, as Cecil Cirillo and Elizabeth Vogel was claiming. Is that your reading of what they were saying?
Well, once again, that's what they said. But it hasn't been put into the language of the contract. You know, they could have very well just specified right then and there to either change the language or put in a definition of what they meant by that.
And this really has been, you know, I guess the concern that Well, SCAN had this concern back on May 31st when it issued its resolution to the general membership, passed it 2-1 in the famous session where Keith Sugar called the tenants, said that they were living in filthy, squalid conditions, packed in like sardines, and well, they should consider going back to Mexico if they didn't like the city's policies. A very famous kind of, you know, made quite a splash in the media. But what SCAN said was, stop this project, put it on hold until you hold a forum and until you guarantee people that there'll be enough housing for them to come back to and that they'll have relocation funding and that this will be explicitly guaranteed by law that everybody who has to leave will be able to return.
Right.
And, you know, some Mayor Sugar kept insisting and Mike Rotkin has kept insisting it's already provided by state law. And
we keep on asking,
what state law?
What state law? Give us even just the section number so we can go look it up.
Now, you actually asked Mayor Sugar this question on October 10th after the council meeting, right?
Right.
And he was going to take you into the office and show you the code section?
That's what he said when we headed to his office.
And then what happened?
When we got there, he said, well, I don't have time to look all these things up. I got other things to do.
Well, didn't he then spend 45 minutes talking with you?
Right.
Well, so apparently he preferred a nice conversation with you than a sort of a boring trip through the law books.
Right. Well, I think that what they're trying to do here is pull a fast one on people. They're trying to say that there's a provision in relocation law that allows them to pay beyond this cap. And there is, but I've never read it myself.
You're talking, of course, about
last resort housing.
The question is, how much money can the city give a family that it's going to, say, send out into the wilderness for 42 months while they build this project, which may take several years? It may take 12 months, 24 months, 36 months, who knows? And how much money, what's the cap on that? Now, you and Phil Baer and I have found this thing which said 52.50 is the amount of money that they can pay people off as a cap, and I guess Seal Cirillo insists that, yeah, if you do a lump payment, that's what it is, but if you, every month, you are obliged to pay the difference between what they were previously paying before and what they're paying in this place they're now living in while they're waiting to move back into the housing. That's what she, I think, has claimed, but we can't find the provision that actually states that, and it would seem that if it's really true,
They bring it out and wave it under our noses.
Right, or alternately they would say, sure, we'll pass that as a resolution to City Council since it's already guaranteed by state law. There's no harm in passing it twice. I mean, you know, who cares?
This cap, 5250, actually exists. I've read it. It's in the law books.
And there is a provision that talks about last resort housing where you can get more money, but the connections are unclear to me, and the specific amounts available are not clear to me. And I know that when we talked to Attorney Reed Chance, who defended people, actually took the city to court to make sure that some of the businesses that were relocated by the city from the Gateway,
the box store, Kennedy Center project.
The Kennedy Center project, right, back in 1995 or 6 or thereabouts, they had a lot of trouble, and they had an attorney on their payroll, and they spoke English, and they had all their legal documentation, unlike tenants of the Dolphin, some of whom are undocumented, probably most of whom are undocumented, many of whom have, you know, no competency in English particularly, and who don't want to spend their time fighting with, you know, a lawyer. They have to spend their time, you know, struggling all day to get enough money to keep things together. So the idea that there's some recourse for these people if these guarantees are not airtight, to me, is really questionable. And I
guess
you take the same view on that.
Right.
Well, I know that, you know, we've been covering this on Free Radio Santa Cruz, and that's what you're tuned to, folks, in case you've been trying to call in and getting a busy signal, because I'm on the line here with activist Scott Graham.
Well, I can always hang up, Robert.
You could.
Get
you could
get your multitude of phone calls.
Could get your butt into the studio, too, and so we could actually both take phone calls, but who knows? I know that you're a man who is no doubt eager to go down to the Sleeping Van Forum, which is being held at the Loudoun Nelson Center. Even as we speak, it started at 7, should be going till 9 or 10. I invite people to come to that.
Is there free food?
I don't know. There's probably food for thought. And who knows? There may be some chips and dips, or certainly there may be some dips. Maybe some Halloween candy, or maybe trick-or-treat. You know, never can tell when some of the city council candidates may show up with more of their promises.
Oh, yeah, right. Robert Steffen.
Robert Steffen, of course, is probably one of the few candidates I actually believe. But he isn't running for city council, unfortunately. Robert Steffen, of course, is the man in the bag down on Pacific Avenue. Who
running for president.
He is running for president, and he is outside, I guess, was it So Say We Cafe? Or that's near the bookshop Santa Cruz for anybody who wants to contribute to his presidential campaign. Well, Scott, I know finally that I'm hoping we can get you in the studio on Sunday to actually discuss this last turn of the screw by the city council when it dumped all this money on Mercy Charities housing and without explicit legal guarantees for the tenants, without even requiring them to have a relocation and replacement housing plan that I can see. Although, you know, that's not entirely clear to me. We tried to find out. I know we talked about Mercy Charities having a closed process. We talked about Mercy Charities, the low-income housing provider, having no competitive bidding required so that they're not, you know, asked to specify how much they'd spend compared to, let's say, a private developer like Maynard Manson or another low-income housing provider like The Bridge or Mid-Peninsula. None of this was, you know, even there was no discussion by city council as to why other people, why competitive bidding was not allowed. We've repeatedly asked this question. Have they ever addressed that issue?
Well, I believe that Tim Fitzmaurice was addressing this issue the other day, and you started assaulting him with a naked hand puppet.
Now, wait a minute. Now, let's not give our listeners a misimpression. I think, as I remember, and you're making a... I don't think, just to answer the point, I don't think that the city council has ever addressed the issue of why, of specifically why the city council has decided Mercy Charities is a better provider than any other low-income housing provider. They've just said...
It's Tim's church. Don't you realize this, Robert?
Well, I don't think that Tim has stated that the Catholic orientation of some of the sponsors of Mercy Charities Housing is necessarily the reason that he's chosen this. I think, in fact, that he would deny that. So I think that what we do know is that the City Council has not had a competitive bidding process, an RFP, a request for proposals, that it hasn't examined the criticisms that some Mercy Charities Housing tenants or victims, as they may style themselves, have had over the years. Mm-hmm. And so there hasn't been... There's been the problem that the city council seems to be blind and deaf to any criticism, and then when we try to get them to talk about the issue, they're also dumb when it comes to the matter of guarantees. I mean, that's, say, speechless, unwilling to talk.
Right.
And also, I would say, dumb in another sense, like morally insensible to the need for these kinds of guarantees, which I think are pretty elementary. So... I know that at the City Council, when Tim Fitzmaurice began praising Mercy Charities Housing, I had just given a speech that said, why are you doing this giveaway of money to Mercy Charities Housing after only 4 days after the breaking the news, and it hasn't been out in the papers, and nobody knows it's happening, and nobody's coming to a noon City Council meeting anyway, except, you know, people who happen to be after coming to the next item, which actually had a sizable crowd, but that was sort of coincidental. And I don't think they were there to talk about or care about the issue of Mercy Charities Housing.
But interestingly enough, many of these people from West Cliff Drive who were there for the next agenda item were clapping when you, me, and Becky spoke.
Really?
Yeah, didn't you notice that? There was people in the... I mean, most of the people in the audience were clapping for what we were saying.
Really? Well, that's reassuring. I wasn't...
These are old, rich people, mostly.
Well, it could be that they liked our spunk.
Right. Could be. Or they just don't like the government throwing away money.
I don't know what problem they would have with the government throwing away money. I mean, after all. I did note that we've had some problems with Keith Sugar in the past, cutting off people at the mic.
Well, let's get back to the naked hand puppet thing.
And now, you know, you're using an interesting phrase, naked hand puppet. I don't think anybody in the audience knows what the hell you're talking about. Let me see if I can throw some light on this situation. I, you know, made a series of criticisms at the mic about how come you're doing all this, you know, with 4-day notice, suddenly giving $1.5 million to Mercy Charities Housing in a proposal that has nowhere been discussed or made public before the Friday before the Tuesday when this happened 2 days ago. You're doing it at a special noon meeting that nobody is going to know is happening. you know, why don't you give it a little break? Wait until after the election. Wait a week. Wait until people get a chance to look at the language. Wait until the guarantees can be, you know, you can define the words legal occupant so everybody is covered, not just people on the lease. Sort of, I think, a series of pretty reasonable elementary concerns. And I then went back to my off to the side where I sort of leaned against the window along the aisle where I usually kind of hang out. I'm very restless, so I don't sit down in the audience seats, but I'm...
Well, if Peter Cook gets elected, you'll have to sit down.
Yes, well, we'll talk about that on Saturday when Cook and his... or Sunday when Cook shows up on the V-Man show. But in any case, then Tim Fitzmaurice launched into a defense, and frankly... I found that there was very little of substance in his defense, and he seemed to go on and on. In fact, so much so that apparently he drove you out of the room.
Oh, yeah, he made me nauseous.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I was ready to barf right there on the floor.
Well, you know, that was a proposal I think you made later on, but let's not jump ahead of ourselves.
Right, to go up to the podium and power puke on him.
I think that would be a very strong statement.
Right.
Yeah, in a way, I mean, I laugh at it. It's a joke, but, you know, it's also a pretty sickening...
A reality.
Yeah, it's a pretty sickening situation. I mean, I don't really feel nauseous when he speaks, as you apparently did. But I felt indignant, and I felt, you know, this is not a response to the concerns raised by myself and others, like Lydia Blanchard, who was also at that meeting, who requested that Mercy Charities, which announced it was having yet another meeting today with the tenants... I'm sorry, that meeting be open to the public, because Mercy Charities Housing has been funded by the City Council all along. Mayor Sugar sits on its board. He votes on its board. The Brown Act, the Public Open Act meeting, Open Meetings Act, I should say, specifically says that such meetings should be open, not only open to the public, but they should have agendas put out beforehand. People should know where they are. Minutes should be available, that sort of thing. And, of course, none of that has been followed by Mercy Charities Housing, and none of that has been, they've not been held to account by Tim Fitzmaurice, who passed the original motion back in January 2000, which established the Mercy Charities Housing Advisory Body overseeing the Dolphin Lee Project. So here they're coming with another meeting today, which, by the way, we didn't learn where it was. I called Seal Cirillo, I called of the Redevelopment Agency, I called Elizabeth Vogel of Mercy Charities Housing, I called Christopher Crone of the City Council. None of these calls were returned.
Well, you're sidestepping the real issue here, Robert.
Well, I'm going to get to the naked hand puppets in just a moment. Anyway, so having done all this, we find that, you know, the process was closed as ever. And what did Tim Fitzmaurice say? Did he explain why we need a star chamber process behind closed doors in this situation? Did he explain why Mercy Charities is so much better than any other low-income housing provider?
Because
no.
He loves them.
Well, for whatever reason,
he's very impressed with them.
He was very impressed, but he didn't give us any specifics, any cost comparisons, any reason why they should demolish the Rex Court. Any show us the red tagging. Show us where it's not habitable. Show us the reports. No, they didn't have any of that stuff available. So, as he went on and on praising Mercy Charities in the most kind of general terminology, I raised my hand off to the side. And I wasn't, like, I wasn't, you know, 5 feet from his face. I was halfway back in the room along the side aisle, and I began moving my thumb and fingers in a sort of a talking motion, as you would...
Hand puppet.
Well, sort of like the shadow, you know, when you do a rabbit shadow on the wall. I was doing that. I was making a motion.